This is the old Bible. This is what we have to do today, is to act like intelligent people and realize that if Israel is accused in different international proceedings of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and even genocide, it's Israel as a state which is to face the consequences, including sanctions and cutting economic ties with Israel as a state.
So, Francesca Albanese, we just have 30 seconds, but if you could talk about, and then we'll continue with you after the program for a taped show, if you could say to what extent you were inspired by the divestment campaign against apartheid South Africa. You spoke about that at the UN.
Certainly I was, of course, but not much. I was more inspired. I mean, not that I was not inspired. It's just that what led me was the need to understand the occupation and the apartheid. And then the campaign made sense to me against apartheid South Africa and against apartheid Israel. Takes time to a lawyer.
Francesca Albanese, I want to thank you for being with us. Please stay with us. We're going to do a post-show, a web exclusive, posted at democracynow.org. UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. We'll link to your report, From Economy of Occupation to Economy of Genocide. She was speaking to us from the U.S. First Lady's, Melania Trump's country, Slovenia. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from Metropolitan Family Services Cash Oregon, committed to improving the financial health of low to moderate income families and individuals by providing free tax preparation services. Volunteers are currently needed to support this program. All training is provided and no tax experience is necessary. More info on volunteering at cashoregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portlanders speak out demanding no more ICE in their city. Many say they also want better solutions for the houseless community, and the mayor responds. And why Oregonians depending on food assistance may be at special risk. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 10th, 2025. I am Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us. A surge of Portlanders swamped city councilors for hours, many demanding they take action on recent immigration and customs enforcement activities in the city. KBOO's Hannah Francis has the story.
The Community and Public Safety Committee held another meeting on Tuesday, July 8th, from 2:30 to 4:45 this week. The meeting was created to take public comment on the Immigration and Customs Enforcement permit to operate out of the McAdams facility in the city of Portland. Councillor Canal created the space for people to testify publicly. He gave a brief introduction, and all members of the council who were on the committee gave a brief comment after public testimony was heard. Mario commented in the start of the meeting, saying that she is grateful for everyone who is taking a stand to stop their neighbors from being abducted.
We have some tough choices ahead of us. The reality is the federal government has $45 billion to open any ICE facility that they want, and they're able to do that in any federal building and on federal land. And there are going to be very delicate things that we are balancing moving forward. So I'm grateful that you're here in this fight with us, and I am eager to listen to all of you today.
The first person to testify, David Medina, spoke in favor of ICE and law enforcement. He referred to city council as the, quote, Gotham City Council. He was booed out of the room after city council gave him an extra 20 seconds in the interest of being fair when his remarks were drowned out among the dissenting onlookers. Leo Barnes was among the people present testifying against the actions of ICE and requesting that their permit be revoked.
The people being detained are not terrorists or criminals. They are farmers, road workers, firefighters, and members of the military doing manual labor this country could not function without, often for far below minimum wage. It is estimated that undocumented people paid $90 billion in taxes last year to a country they are not represented in and are punished for trying to legally immigrate to. Some of them are grandparents. Some of them are children that need to be given booster seats because they're too small to fit in the courthouse chairs. At best, deportation rips them out of their life and away from their families. At worst, it results in death. Systemic racism is a construct which relies on complacency in order to survive. We must not cooperate in any capacity for we are to have any hope of dissolving it. Revoking ICE's permit is absolutely a necessary step in protecting our community and in fighting back against the wave of escalating intolerance and fascism in the United States. Thank you for your time.
A man named Brian Owendoff testified that he was concerned about the quote-unquote unrelenting noise that was caused by the protesters that is disturbing the people who are living in the neighborhood.
I strongly support the right to peaceful protest, but when demonstrations cross the line into harassment, violence, and disruption of neighborhoods, the city has a duty to intervene consistently and lawfully. Over 500 residents live within a three-block radius of the federal facility. For weeks, these neighbors, many of whom are low-income renters, veterans, and individuals struggling with PTSD, have endured unrelenting noise that violates city ordinances nightly from sundown to 2 a.m. This is not a free speech or First Amendment issue. This is a public safety and quality of life issue.
Soren Black testified in nearly a direct response following Brian Owendoff.
Privilege stunts your growth, keeping you hindered in a bubble of ignorance, making you incapable of understanding the weight of the world others bear. So you don't have to. It's a muffled image of reality. You can't hear the screams because you don't want to sacrifice your own peace. You're too far away to see the bloodshed and too emotionally stunted. You're too numb and too detached until it affects you. This is how he wants you to be. Your empathy has been stolen in disguise of protecting a lie that has been projected on you since birth. Why does it only apply to you, this so-called dream? Our community is what makes us human. I was taught that everyone has a chance here, yet I wasn't told who we were discussing was subjective. It is conditional and singular. I will not stand by and see my neighbors, family, friends, comrades being beaten, stolen, and killed. There is privilege in being able to speak out about this and not have your livelihood destroyed. More people need to speak up.
There were many other people who testified in the meeting that was over 2 hours long. But to close the meeting, Councillor Canall asked for the councillors to give closing remarks.
Often when we've done these public hearings, we just kind of adjourn. And I think that's often appropriate. Many of you have been here this entire time, and I want you to understand that we want to react, and we actually have a few minutes for it. And so I'm going to give each of the members of this committee the opportunity to kind of speak for a minute and just kind of give any thoughts that they have in reaction to what we've heard today.
But maintaining sanctuary cities and counties is even more important now. The risks are higher, and the current president is likely abusing the law to crack down on the city of Los Angeles under the guise of immigration enforcement.
This is an ungodly time in our community, in our country, and you've made your opinion very clear, and I appreciate that. I think that masked, anonymous operations are completely reprehensible. They are dishonorable.
One thing that somebody said that we should reiterate is that I don't think that there's anything to be gained by appeasement against this administration. We should not be trying to figure out how to keep our heads low and avoid the attention of this administration. Because, as you all know, the assault on immigrants, like the assault on Jews in Nazi Germany, is part, a horrific part, but part of a larger pattern. An administration that is assaulting freedom of the press, that is assaulting the rule of law.
I know I'm not supposed to argue with people when they provide testimony, but I have to outrightly reject any narratives that some people brought up saying that ICE is keeping our community safe, or that the majority of immigrants that are being kidnapped, detained, and disappeared are criminals. We are not criminals. I've been in the United States since I was 4 years old, and my single mother brought us here hoping that we would have a better life, and I don't think she ever imagined that this would be the time that we are in right now. The comments that I made, I think last week, on the moral versus the bureaucratic imperative that we face as city councilors were made before we had more information about the potential violations that have been done by ICE at the McAdam building and the violations regarding their permits. And that does change the calculation for me when we're talking about this, because if we allow ICE to continue to operate when they have violated their permits, that means that anything becomes permissible moving forward.
The use of tear gas, I studied international humanitarian law. That's one of my master's degrees in. The use of chemical munitions is unconscionable in war, and it should be even more unconscionable when used against your own people. Somebody said that they had video of a second time of a barricade being cleared. Please send that to me. If anyone wants to get in contact with my office, all of our offices, the contact info is at portland.gov/our last name. I hope that at some point during my time in office, there will be a last time we meet to talk about it, because we won't have ICE here. I hope that that happens. We know it's not going to happen tomorrow. So this is the second meeting where we're having this conversation, and I look forward to more conversations with my colleagues as well as hearing from you as we go. And I will say that my calculus has changed as well.
There will be more meetings on July 15th and July 22nd regarding this issue. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Hannah Francis.
Meantime, the Trump administration is intensifying efforts to deport people, including U.S. citizens deemed illegal immigrants. President Trump has directed the Department of Justice to prioritize stripping naturalized citizens of their citizenship based on criminal history. In a memo published on June 11th, the DOJ is urged to initiate civil proceedings to revoke citizenship if an individual illegally procured naturalization or did so through concealment of a material fact or willful misrepresentation. Assistant Attorney General Brett Shumate's memo grants lawyers the discretion to pursue denaturalization cases that align with the administration's policy objectives on immigration enforcement in the United States. This directive follows a report from Immigration and Customs Enforcement about another in-custody death of an immigrant. It's 13th in-custody death since the start of the fiscal year in October. The memo outlines several priorities for the DOJ, including combating anti-Semitism, taking legal action against sanctuary cities, and increasing denaturalization cases. It specifically instructs lawyers to focus on immigrants who may pose a potential danger to national security, as well as any other significant cases referred to the Civil Division. U.S. attorneys are now encouraged to pursue denaturalization cases involving individuals engaged in torture, war crimes, or human trafficking. Shumate emphasizes that the Civil Division should prioritize and maximally pursue denaturalization proceedings in all legally supported cases. Immigration lawyer Rosanna Berardi noticed that this memo signals a broader approach by the DOJ, a shift towards pursuing more cases not only against terrorists or war criminals, but also those with undisclosed criminal records or errors during naturalization. She says in her 28 years of practice, the government has generally left naturalized citizens alone. This marks a significant departure. According to the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, from 1990 to 2017, only 11 denaturalization cases were pursued. However, during Trump's first presidency, that number surged to 1,600 cases referred to the DOJ for prosecution. According to a new PBS News NPR Marist poll, a majority of Americans believe the Trump administration has gone too far on immigration enforcement. More on this from Eric Galatis.
Some 15 community and faith-based organizations gathered again this week outside the GEO Group ICE detention facility in Aurora, where longtime Denver resident and activist Jeanette Vizguerra is being held. Protesters have gathered weekly after U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents arrested Vizguerra during her work break at Target on March 17th. Nate Casa with the Party for Socialism and Liberation was a safety marshal during the demonstration calling for her release.
We're here today to demand freedom for Jeanette Vizguerra. She's been imprisoned by the Trump administration for exercising her First Amendment right of free speech and to speak out for the unjust detentions of people like her and other immigrants across this country.
Vizguerra was recently named a 2025 recipient of the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award for her moral courage and willingness to act on convictions even at great personal risk. ICE officials have called Vizguerra a convicted criminal alien for entering and remaining in the U.S. without proper documentation, an act the Trump administration considers illegal. ICE also says she's received due process and that a judge has issued a final order for her deportation. 8 in 10 Americans support deporting immigrants who have been convicted of a violent crime, according to a new poll. But after the arrest of documented student activists by masked agents and the deployment of active military personnel on U.S. soil, a majority of Americans say the Trump administration has gone too far. Yoselyn Corrales with the group Aurora Unidos says it's important to stand up against what she sees as the criminalization of people who are politically active.
We've seen this across our country with activists being arrested and persecuted by the police and by the FBI, and we will not stand for our voices being silenced.
President Donald Trump campaigned on the promise of mass deportations, and the budget reconciliation bill passed by Congress last week includes the largest investment in detention and deportation in U.S. history. The law earmarks $170 billion to fund Trump's immigration plans, including $45 billion to build new detention centers. This is Eric Golatis.
Donald Trump's Big Beautiful Bill looks especially dangerous to Oregonians counting on food stamp assistance. KBOO's Josh Salem tells us more.
1 in 6 Oregonians receive help from the government-run food stamp program. About half are seniors, people with disabilities, and children. The recent passage of Donald Trump's domestic policy bill puts their benefits at significant risk. According to food assistance advocates, more Oregonian families will face days with fewer meals. The legislation, called the One Big Beautiful Bill, is Trump's signature legislative accomplishment. It slashes social safety net programs like the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program and Medicaid, while extending previous tax cuts and adding some new ones, including for some tips and overtime pay. It increases funding for national defense and border security. The bill will make it harder for people to qualify for SNAP. For example, persons will have to continue to hold a job while receiving benefits until the age of 64, rather than the previous requirement of 54. Scott Cooper, the executive director of Neighbor Impact, which provides anti-poverty services in Central Oregon, said, quote, "The idea that we are going to send hundreds of thousands of people into hunger is a very, very worrying, sad moment for me. We're trying to do something about it, but there's only so much you can do," end quote. Republicans have called the bill's passage a major step toward fiscal responsibility. Party members have argued that the SNAP program is managed poorly and prompts people to rely too heavily on the government while avoiding having to work. U.S. Representative Cliff Benz, a Republican, was Oregon's only member of Congress to vote yes on the spending bill. The bill's passage comes at a time when a growing number of people are seeking help from food banks in Oregon and Southwest Washington. Total visits increased from about 860,000 in 2019 to 2.5 million in 2024. As many as 740,000 people get help here from monthly SNAP. Even before the bill passed, food banks were dealing with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's decision to cancel its food purchase program through the Commodity Credit Corporation. One Central Oregon organization served about 88,000 fewer meals last quarter, a drop of more than 110,000 pounds of food. Interestingly, an amendment to the bill allows states with especially high error rates, the rate at which a state either over- or underpaid benefits, to postpone costs associated with SNAP cuts for a year. Oregon has one of the nation's highest such rates. But the Oregon Department of Human Services estimates the state will face $425 million in new yearly costs starting in 2028. How the state plans to cover those costs remains unclear, but we may have to reduce or even eliminate our own SNAP coverage. The agency itself said, quote, "This would leave tens of thousands of people in Oregon without food, undermining the promise of a national food program," end quote. Governor Kotek has directed state agencies to urgently evaluate impacts of the federal budget on Oregon. Her office stated, quote, "The governor believes that every dollar stripped from those families and put toward the top 1% is a moral failure. Oregon does not have the state resources to bear the weight of those costs," end quote. The state legislature did not pass bills that sought to pull monies from the state's general fund for food assistance. Oregon lawmakers did just pass a budget that included cuts to other anti-poverty services, like eviction prevention. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A public hearing about homelessness and housing in Portland brought a strong response. Here are some of the comments about the city's plan for a new shelter in the Pearl that would accommodate as many as 200 beds.
My name is Chris Makoviak. My office is in the Pearl, and much of my business is in the Pearl. I have volunteered with the Pearl Neighborhood Association since 2018. I am a Pearl Neighborhood Association board member. I serve on the Neighborhood Safety and Livability Committee, and I help lead our neighborhood's all-volunteer clean team program, which I am especially proud of. At this point, I've volunteered hundreds of hours in the Pearl. Every once in a while, someone will ask me why I volunteer. I say the same thing every time. I do it for the people I volunteer with. So let me tell you about those people. There's Sally and John. Both are in their 80s, but still volunteer multiple times per week, picking up trash in the neighborhood. I've watched Sally pick up hundreds of needles and put them into her own sharps container. The city wouldn't do it, so that responsibility to keep people in the neighborhood, including kids, safe from used needles fell to her. I've watched John limp down a street picking up trash because even though his hip hurt that day, he thought cleaning up and being a positive force in the neighborhood was too important to miss. I've watched Ty, who uses a scooter for mobility, clean up glass with the broom and dustpan he always brings, just for the broken glass, which you shouldn't be surprised to hear is common. I could go on. If you asked Sally, John, or Ty what they thought about the planned shelters, what do you think they would tell you? They would tell you, don't do this. They would tell you, two night-only shelters in the middle of a highly residential neighborhood already struggling with real safety and livability issues, and more and more and more empty storefronts is a bad idea. They'd tell you putting people directly out into the neighborhood at 6 a.m. when the shelter closes is a bad idea. They'd tell you having no plan for sanitation, security, or mental health services is a bad idea.
My name is Judy Cloper. I live in the Pearl District, and before you think of me as a NIMBY, lacking in compassion for the homeless, please know that I also come to you as a parent of an adult child who spent almost 20 years abusing drugs, mostly meth. For 10 of those years, she was homeless, 5 of those years in and out of shelters in Linn County. Sometimes she was camping on highway ramps or at the river or in neighborhoods. She would cause damage to a store if they didn't give her what she wanted. She would find a shelter and move in, but because they were high barrier shelters and she refused to follow their rules of no drugs and residents had to do chores, she would leave. I will never forget the day I drove into Albany and saw my daughter walking. Fast forward to now. For the past 8.5 years, she has been clean, holding down a job, living in a little home. What changed her? It was the time in jail, the good graces of the judge and the district attorney, who is now a judge in Linn County, who sent her to the state hospital, the therapy she received, the return to the homeless shelter that offered her services, the help with getting care for her mental health issues and taking medication, getting a job with a vocational aide, the love of her family, and her decision to change.
Todd Littlefield, District 1. I've got 3 asks. First, fully support what the Mayor Wilson's going to propose. 2, the homelessness is costing the city billions of dollars a year. And we can't have them continuing to be wherever they want to be. So Dignity Village is out in Sunderland Road by the airport. There's a whole bunch of land out there between there and the airport. Big, huge plots. Why don't we buy some land out there, have sanctioned camping, so that these people have a place to go? It might not be the Taj Mahal, but they're not used to the Taj Mahal. So that's what I would strongly recommend we do. And 3, ODOT, the MUP runs about 26 miles long. It affects many residences, many neighborhoods. And it goes from just south of Fortland Marine Drive along I-205 and then along I-84 from 118th to about 222nd. They have been derelict in duty and responsibility for their property. I talked to the regional manager about 2 years ago. He said, we have no money. Now he's saying we have no money. So I own some vacant lots, and the city has a code. You can't have grass over 10 inches tall. So ODOT currently has grass and weeds 3 to 4 inches tall. They've got no trespassing signs throughout their property. People aren't just trespassing, they're living. They're destroying our lives. And so I just hope that you support Mayor Wilson. You look at sanctioned camping out by the airport. TriMet bus runs right by Dignity Village. And you hold ODOT to account.
Meantime, Portland Mayor Keith Wilson, who promised during his campaign to end unsheltered homelessness within a year, talked to members of the East Portland Chamber this week.
We're really making great strides on our focused end of shelter homelessness to provide a safe bed for every person. I'm working with Chief right now. So we're going to start our revitalization plan in Old Town because that's what Mayor Clark did 40 years ago. He had the same sort of challenges that we have today. He had heroin and fortified wine, and we had an awful lot of unsheltered homelessness living in Old Town. So we're just going to like recreate that very important learned experience we had over the years. So we're really not creating anything new, and none of it is, you know, based on cruelty. It's just basically being very clear and very accountable that we want to help you. What does it look like? But you can't stay here. But what I've been working on is making sure that the place we're offering is better than here. So if you're business owners, East Portland Chamber of Commerce, we know that people are living in your shop's corridors. They're treating it like a toilet or a bedroom. That's not decent for you and your livability, nor for that individual. So we're going to be really removing those individuals and applying our law, because it's against the law and you can't camp. There's no tents. That's not lawful. Makeshift shelters and RVs. I was talking about the RVs. We're moving from 50 RV mitigations to 150 in the coming months. So we're really just going to do the basics of addressing the public safety space. And our police officers are overwhelmed with calls for service, not for accidents or when you have an RV or your loved one, but oftentimes their call outs are for the unsheltered suffering on the street, which then impacts our ability to respond when you call. You have an accident or whatever the case may be. And then we get to that third leg, pretty straightforward. The third leg is revitalizing our economy. It's ensuring that the resources that we've always had, you know, we've grown for 40 years up until just 5 years ago. We have population loss. We have business failures. Just in one neighborhood adjacent to the Old Town, just 2 years ago in 2023, they had 95 closed storefronts. Today, they have 115 closed storefronts. Those are good businesses. And behind those windows or shops was a broken dream. And so that's really what we're here to do, is get back to basics. In fact, I framed it as such. Get back to basics. We're not in cut exercises in what's where we'll see our revenue falling. Our goal is to do a twin approach. We want revenue to gain through taxes and people moving here, economic vitality, and then we'll focus on the expense side. And that allows us to really turn our city around. And I'm happy to say things are moving forward. Everything that I've been talking to you about for years, the counselors believe in it as well. And it is moving forward. We've made this promise and we have 145 days before December 1st. Every meeting at City Hall begins with that number. How many days before December 1st? Because we want everybody to know we must act with a sense of urgency. There is no tomorrow. We're not going to have a 3 or 5 year plan. It is the 1 year plan to turn the narrative that Portland is bogus to you and your neighbors, and we're on our way. I'm excited.
Some grassroots candidates hope to gain traction in Western states. The new budget law slashes rural energy funds. Brazil faces steep tariffs, and only select African leaders are invited to the White House summit. For more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2025 Talks.
The Florida Supreme Court won't revive a law criminalizing the entry of undocumented migrants into the state. That leaves in place a lower court ruling against the law. In Texas, the search continues for the missing after the worst inland flooding disaster in half a century. The governor says a special legislative session starting in 2 weeks will consider flood response. President Donald Trump hosted 5 African heads of state at the White House for a private lunch focused on commercial opportunities. The event excluded most of the continent, and Trump's comments to Liberia's president drew attention.
Such good English. Where were you educated? Where? In Liberia.
Liberia was founded by free African Americans before the Civil War, and English is the primary official language. Wednesday, Trump also said he would impose massive tariffs on Brazilian imports in response to the prosecution of the right-wing former president. Jair Bolsonaro faces charges that he attempted to lead a coup to stay in power. The Justice Department is reviewing misconduct accusations against officials who investigated Russian election interference, including former directors of the FBI and CIA. Alaska's rural energy providers say Trump's budget cuts critical support for renewable power, leaving remote communities stuck with expensive diesel fuel. Pierre Lone Wolf with the Kotzebue Electric Association Power Co-op says their projects would have lowered bills.
That has put the kibosh on our wind project, which we are partnering with the local tribe to install two more 1 megawatt wind turbines and another megawatt or so of solar.
Alaska's Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski supported the mega bill after securing funding for tribal whale hunters and modest renewable carve-outs. Organizers across the Dakotas and Mountain West want to help everyday people enter public service. Gwen Lackalt with the Western Organization of Resource Councils says the strategy is already paying off.
In 2024, we saw 12 seats that were flipped in the state of Montana by your very ordinary Montanan.
I'm Farah Siddiqui.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Hannah Francis, and James Kemp. The producer's Annette Newell and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM,